So it's a great pleasure to be talking to you, Scarlett, after all these years. And I wondered if we could start. You were born in 1922 in Vienna. Can you say something about your family and your family background?
Yes, I was born in Vienna, the youngest child of two elder brothers. And everything seemed to have just a normal childhood, and I am Jewish, but at first we lived in a district which was almost wholly Jewish, so there wasn't any problem. But my father was one of the early social democrats who was involved in the abolition of the Austrian monarchy, and was one of the early social democrats, and he was an atheist. So I grew up without any Jewish identity whatsoever. All I knew was that I was Jewish, but didn't make any difference. We didn't celebrate any of the Jewish rituals or festivals, nor of course any of the Christian ones. And then because my father was one of the early social democrats, we were offered an apartment in the Karl Marx building. Austria actually pioneered council houses, and it was a social experiment. They brought people there right out of the slums and put them into brand new apartments. And it was a success, because very few of them really sort of spoiled the apartments. They really rose to the occasion. And so they also wanted to put a few Jewish families into it. And so we got this apartment. And for us it meant, because in the Jewish district where we used to live, we had a very small apartment. And my father was a commercial traveler by that time in Yugoslavia. So was my mother and my two elder brothers, and we moved into this Karl Marx building, and I was obviously had to change primary school. That was in 1930, and so I went to a school in the street. Actually, we looked down from my classroom, we looked down on a house where Beethoven used to live. And opposite the school, there was a park which was called the Eroica Park, because Beethoven composed the Eroica Symphony there. And I was the only Jewish child that was enrolled in that school. And this didn't really worry me. And I looked around. My mother took me there. And I looked around, and I noticed a few faces of children in the class where I knew I would join. And then when we walked back to the Karl Marx building and in the afternoon, and the Karl Marx building was really an experiment in social living. They provided a park, nurseries for small children, laundry places. Each resident had 2 days a month to do their laundry, and there were washing machines and automatic laundering machines. So it was really very, very progressive, very avant-garde, and people like then the Prince of Wales, who subsequently became King Edward and then resigned, he visited, and I remember seeing him when I was helping my mother with the washing. And so as we came back, I then went down into this garden, and I spotted a few faces of children that I'd noticed in the morning. And they were playing games, and I wanted to join. And they began to shout, "Saujudin, you pig of a Jew." And I was horrified. I'd never heard this before, and I dived upstairs to my mother and said, "Why do they do this?" And then my mother, in her wisdom, said, "Well, you are Jewish, and I know we haven't brought up our children with any Jewish identity, but you are Jewish, and if you are Jewish, you have to be prepared for this kind of treatment." So this was the first experience of anti-Semitism that I had. And then in 1934, there was the civil war in Austria, when the social democratic government was ousted, and the Karl Marx building was one of the fortresses where the social, difficult to translate, the guard of the Social Democratic Party, the young people that had been trained in fighting, had machine guns and tried to oppose the conquering of by the Christian socialists, who were the sort of ancestors of the National Socialists. And that was in 1934, and that is when, for the first time in my life, I saw a person shot dead. Because, and he was pretty dangerous, well, and my brother, who is the eldest brother, who is 10 years older than I am, who was by that time already a student at the University of Technology in Vienna, and was also a member of the Socialist Guard, of the Students' Guard, and therefore was supposed to be involved in the fighting. But somehow he got himself out of it and he came to see us. And then he insisted on going back, and my mother was terribly upset to see him go. And when he left, we sat there in silence, and about 5 minutes later we heard the first shots fired. And of course we thought he would be dead, but he came back. And we then left, and we were safe and nothing happened to us personally. But it was quite a traumatic experience for a 12-year-old young girl to see the first person shot dead and bleeding to death. And then, of course, in 1938, the Anschluss occurred, and that was the end of Austria's independence. And before that, it was actually politically very interesting. There was a chancellor called Schuschnigg, who then was taken to concentration camp and ultimately came to America and became a professor at a fifth-rate American university and died there. But anyway, Schuschnigg was asked by Hitler to come to Berchtesgaden, and because Hitler was determined to annex Austria, since he was Austrian himself. And Schuschnigg then didn't want to give up Austria's independence. And so the Social Democratic Party that had been illegal after the 1934 Civil War, for the last few months in 1937 and the beginning of 1938, the party was declared legal again and there could be demonstrations. So it was a sort of honeymoon period, which didn't last very long because Hitler didn't take no for an answer and obviously crossed the border. And then, of course, in 1938, I was then 15 years old. And in a sense, I matured overnight. My brother, who was quite ingenious, you know, he was one who said immediately, we must leave. Because many of the Jews that perished in concentration camps could have survived had they been prepared to cut their roots and leave. But it's very difficult to uproot yourselves, but it was really my brother who saved our lives. And he was one of the early immigrants to England, and he then tried to get us out too. And so when he left, my father was a commercial traveler in Yugoslavia, and we stopped him because there was supposed to have been a referendum. This is what Chancellor Schuschnigg had organized, a referendum on the 13th of March 1938 for the Austrian public to vote whether they wanted to join with Germany or not. And of course, Hitler didn't want to risk a no vote, although I'm sure he wouldn't have had a no vote. But he didn't want to risk that, though. On the 11th of March, the German troops crossed the Austrian border, and Austria was finished at that time. And my brother then left Austria in end of April 1938. So there was only my mother and another brother who was 44 years older than I, and both my mother and my brother were terribly scared of what was going on. But my elder brother and I, we were much more the same kind of person. We wanted to do things and really try and get out. So when my brother had left, I became acting head of household, which was quite a tall order for a young girl. And I used to dress up in the uniform of the Association of German Girls. And I didn't look particularly Jewish, so I could pass. And this was a fantastic experience, because I saw things which made quite an impression on me at the time. And for instance, the different response to the atrocities to which these Jews were subjected by, on the one hand, the group of Orthodox Jews who looked at their torturers with contempt. They felt they were superior, whereas those assimilated Jews were completely devastated and couldn't take, they had nothing to hold on to. And this has made a very strong impression on me. And of course, we were also the Jewish, I was then at high school in what was a Realgymnasium, and we were thrown out of school, and the Jewish children were collected in one school which had been a prestigious school, but the Nazis dismissed all the teachers and substituted young Nazis who had no teaching experience, but they had a history of being supporters of the National Socialist Party. And when we were given our certificates, the teacher who handed them out to us said, "I hope that very few of you will get out of Austria, that you will all perish here. But if any of you will get out, I'm sure you will end in the gutter," which was a very nice thing to hear when you are 15 or 16 years old. And it was at that point in time that I felt that our parents had not done us a good thing in not giving us a Jewish identity, because I felt I was being persecuted for something of which I had never had any positive experience. So, and it was at that point in time that I thought, if ever I get out of here, if ever I get married, if ever I have children, I will jolly well make sure that they will have a strong Jewish identity. So if it happened to them, they wouldn't be as destroyed as I felt inwardly, although outwardly I seemed to manage all right. And I've been giving talks now here, and usually Bill, my husband, who came from very strong Jewish background and I learned to keep a kosher home once I married him. I would say at that point in time, I drew up a job specification for my husband and I found him. He fitted my specification ideally. So,
this is fascinating, but we better get slowly towards England and anthropology. Did you, at what point did you leave Austria?
Well, I left Austria in July 38 and went with my mother to Yugoslavia, where we joined my father, and he was then persecuted there because he was an illegal worker there. And he was then taken to the police and threatened with being sent back to Austria. And then my mother's and my permit, we had visitor's permit, also expired. And at the time, although the Allies post facto said that they cared for refugees, but if you wanted to get a visa, and of course we had passports with a big red J, therefore if you went to any embassy anywhere, you couldn't get a visa. So there we were in Yugoslavia without anywhere to go. And then through, my mother had a sister in Zagreb with whom we stayed. And my uncle then found somebody who heard that Albania, King Zog of Albania, offered tourist visas, and he didn't really care whether Jews came along because he was celebrating his 25th anniversary of his accession to the throne. So we went to Albania. And this actually was my first contact with a developing society, because Albania, and I guess it hasn't changed very much since then, but it certainly was an undeveloped society. And it was a very interesting experience for me. And I was there as we arrived in Albania by ship from Spalato, we were met by one German, one Austrian refugee, and it seemed by the time that we arrived, there were already 40 refugees there who were supported by the International Jewish Agency, with very little funds, but you could survive. And they lived in a commune, so they welcomed us. And we then joined this commune, and the commune was situated, was the house next to the Durazzo, which is the port of Albania where we were, next to the police station. And then Mussolini, having seen Hitler annex Austria, wanted to annex Albania. And I had been asked to teach German and French to two young girls. I was the only refugee that earned a little bit of money because I was teaching these two girls. And the Italian consul in Durazzo heard that I was teaching German. So, of course, Italy and Germany were hand in glove. So he thought he better learns German. So I then was asked to teach him German too, which ultimately saved our life. And so then when Mussolini's troops came ashore, the police station had warned us. We got on quite well with the Albanians. They were actually very wonderful to us. They warned us that on the roof of their police station was the only machine gun, the defense of Albania against the might of the Italian navy and forces. And so if the Italian would obviously want to destroy that machine gun, and if they missed, we would be hit. So they said, you must leave that house and find some shelter. So we did. And I did my first social survey then, which was very interesting, because we got shelter in one of the large houses, and I went round and asked each one of the refugees what they had taken with. And what was very surprising was that about 80% said that they'd taken their documents, because they were afraid that they would lose their total identity if they didn't have their passports. Anyway, then as the fighting ceased, because the Albanians couldn't defend themselves against the Italian might, then the sort of elders of the refugees held a council and said, well, we must now go out into the street. And we were all resigned that we would be shipped to the German concentration camp. And none of them, so I'd been teaching Italian-speaking Albanian. So in that process, I'd learned quite a bit of Italian, and I was the only one who could speak Italian on behalf of us refugees. So the elders decided that we should go up and walk, try and get back to our house there, and I should lead the procession and carry a white handkerchief tied to a stick as that we surrender. And so we did, and we walked very slowly, and there wasn't anybody in the road. And all of a sudden, round from a corner, came Italian soldiers and an officer leading them with their bayonets pointing. And when they saw this motley procession coming along, they shouted, "Halt!" So I told my lot to stop. And then he came up to me and said to me, "Who are you?" And I had rehearsed in Italian to say that we are Austrians and German. And I was going to say German Jewish refugees. Well, as soon as he had heard me say Austrians and Germans, he threw his arms around my neck and said, "We are friends, you know, Germany and Italy." So I thought it wouldn't be wise to disillusion him. And so he sent soldiers to protect us, to go back to we live all together. And so we went back. And by that time, actually, my brother had already got permits for my mother, a domestic permit, to come to England. And also for me, a trainee permit, because the British Home Office was prepared to allow, because it wasn't so long before the war, 1939 by then, and they wanted unskilled labor. So my mother was supposed to be a domestic and I a trainee. And of course with the Italian occupation, the whole thing, you couldn't leave. And the Jewish International Organization paid for the fares or flights if Jewish refugees could show that they had a visa for a safe country like England, they would pay for the fare. So I then went to the French, because we could have taken the plane from Albania. Of course, at that time, planes had to come down and refuel. They couldn't fly long distance. So I went to the French embassy, because we would have had to take a plane that would have touched down in France. And the French embassy in 1939, in March 1939, would not allow even that you take a plane that would only stop for half an hour in a French airport for anybody with a big red J to mount. So that was out. So then I managed to book us a ship that would go from Naples to Southampton. And my brother had said he'd already extended our permits to our visas. And he said, "You must be in England before end of April 39, because I cannot get a further extension." And we still hadn't got a permit for my father. But he said, "You and mother must come, because otherwise I can't do it again." So I managed to book on a freighter that was supposed to sail from Naples, I think, on the 15th of April and arrive at Southampton on the 28th of April, so before the end of April. And so my mother and I left my father behind, and we went to Naples. And I had a voucher being given by the agent in Albania for this freighter. And when I turned up as the shipping company at Naples, they said, "Oh, the freighter is a month late." So that was that. So that, and I was then 16 years, and I thought, well, what do I do now? So I sat down on a bench and I looked across, and there was the CIT, which is the Italian tourist office. And so I went there, and I told the guy that I showed him we've had visas, the visas we already had in our passport for England. I said, "Can you arrange to get my mother and I to England before the end of April?" And the guy said, "Oh yes, I'll book you on a flight via France." I said, "No, you won't succeed." And he said, "Yes, I will." And I said, "Try." But of course he had to come back and say no. And the only way in which we, by which we could get to England before the end of April, was to fly via Germany, which I thought was pretty dangerous, and it turned out to be very dangerous. And so I had no option. I had to book that, and I had the money because I'd been given money in case of emergency. And I told my mother we were going to fly to England. And my mother was so shocked, I mean, the whole experience of emigration. For me, in a sense, it was still an adventure. But for an older person, it wasn't an adventure. It was a disaster. So off we went, and we took the plane. And the first stop was Frankfurt. And it was a KLM, the Dutch airline. So when I got on board, I thought I'd better tell. And before I left, I sent my brother a telegram in London, telling him that we are flying via London, giving him that we are flying via Germany to London, and giving him the time of arrival in London, and saying, if we don't turn up, then you know what has happened. And so we stopped. So when I got on board of the plane, I told the Dutch steward that we are Jewish refugees, and is it possible that we can stay on board when we touch down in Frankfurt? And he said, no, the Germans insist that everybody comes ashore. So when we got there and we saw all these stormtroopers and the flags with swastikas, so we had to go, and I said to my mother, was absolutely, she couldn't stop her trembling. And so we walked to the immigration, and when they saw our passport, they said, Rückwanderer, returned refugees. And I said, no, we are on our way to England. And I showed him the visa, and he let us go back onto the airplane. So I said, fine. And the next stop was Köln, Cologne. And again, I reminded the steward that we may have a problem. And as we came, we had to come off the plane. And as we walked across the tarmac to the building, the loudspeaker announced that my mother and I should report. So we did. And there were two absolute Nazi bitches there, in, uniform and with steely blue eyes, and they said, what are you two Jewish pigs smuggling out of Germany? And I said, nothing. And my mother just stood there, and she was shaking like a leaf. It was horrible. And so they then said, strip completely. So we had to, and I tried, my mother just couldn't even undress herself, and I tried to help her, and they stopped. And so we then stood there stark naked, and they looked through every part of our clothes and our handbag, but I mean, we didn't have anything. But what I did have was actually, which I should say, after the conquering of Albania by the Italian, the Italian consul, who I had been teaching German, had become the governor of Albania, and he wanted to continue learning German. So he had given me a letter in Italian with lots of stamps on it, and every day he used to send his big car, and I would go to his building, where he lived, and teach him German. And I had this letter in my wallet, and they found this letter. And when they saw this was full Italian stamps, they said, what is this? And I must say, with hindsight, I really am surprised that I was so quick on the ball. But I seem to realize that this may be our saving grace. And so I said, well, this is a letter from the governor of the Italian governor of Albania. And I'm a personal friend, and he knows that I'm on this plane. And if I don't arrive in London, he will also know. and who will have stopped me will get into trouble. And they kept saying, you're lying. And I said, well, if you don't know Italian, go and find somebody to translate it for you. And I was still standing there stark naked. And so one of them went out, and then we were standing there. Maybe it's difficult to, but it must have been at least half an hour. And then she came back and she said, get dressed. And we got dressed, and she said, well, you can go back onto the plane. And I said, our passports, because they held our passports. And I said, well, you're jolly glad that we let you all back on the plane, the passports stay here. Well, then I knew we, without passport, we wouldn't be able to get into England. But anyway, we walked back to the plane. Of course, that time you had to walk over the tarmac. And the Dutch steward was standing at the top of the steps. And he was sort of waving when he saw us. And I pointed out that things were not really good. And as we came up the steps, I said, we haven't got our passports and we're lost. So he said, leave it with me. And he went back and he returned with our passports. So that was a happy ending. And actually he had kept the plane because he told us the plane should have left because it was only due to stop there for about 40 minutes. And we'd been about 2 hours. And he had announced over the microphone in the plane that they are keeping the plane waiting for two passengers. So this was a happy ending. And so that's when we finally landed in England.
Amazing story. Well, it was worth having. So you arrived in London Airport.
On London Airport, on Hitler's birthday. Hmm. And then I had a trainee permit, and for the first 2 days my brother put us up in a boarding house, and then I was supposed to start work, and he took me, and of course I didn't know a word of English at the time, and so he took me to this hairdresser, which was, he had told me I would be a hairdresser trainee, and in my mind it conjured up an image of the hairdressers as loans that I'd seen in Vienna. You know, with nice pink or blue decorations and, you know, looking very nice and civilized. But when we turned up at this hairdresser in the East End of London, it was the filthiest shop that I'd ever seen, with lots of hair on the floor and really very dirty. And when I saw this, I shook my head and I said, no. And the guy, the hairdresser, obviously couldn't speak German, so my brother had to translate. And then I said to my brother, I won't stay here. And the hairdresser really wanted to. He had 6 daughters, and he was Jewish, and he thought, well, he's doing a good deed. He's helping a Jewish refugee girl to come over. And one more girl will make very little difference. I could stay with them. And he offered me 6 pence per week, which wouldn't have even paid the bus fare to visit my mother. So I said no. And we often joke about it now, my brother and I, because he now realizes if I hadn't insisted, I would have ended up as a hairdresser instead of as a professor of anthropology. So I then went to Bloomsbury House, which was the refugee center where everybody registered, and they had different desks, and one dealt with young people, and there were all the other young people were there queuing up, and everybody wanted a scholarship to go back to school. And I then had decided I wasn't never going to look at a book again, because the book learning hadn't enabled me to earn my living. I had no skills to offer. So when it was my turn and I said, have you got any jobs? The ladies here almost fell off their chairs when they found a youngster that was prepared to earn her living. And so at that time, of course, there was already a growing demand for unskilled labor. So they gave me addresses of about 15 Jewish firms that were prepared to employ refugees with a trainee permit. So I came home, and my brother then put down the, you know, worked out the way I should go from one firm to the other to find out where I would finally end up. And I then ended up as a machinist making ladies' underwear for M&S, Marks and Spencer, and the firm was in the East End of London. Well, then I continued being a machinist, and then we moved to Manchester because my elder brother left for Australia before the beginning of the war, and the other brother was already in Manchester. So my father also came to England from Albania before the war started. And so we all moved to Manchester, where I continued being a machinist. By that time the war had started, and I was making soldiers' uniforms and soldiers' dressing gowns. But then by that time I felt I really wanted to study again. It wasn't so bad to read and learn and write. And so during the lunch hour, but then I'd always wanted to become a medical doctor. I'd never really thought of anthropology, but a medical doctor was my ambition and had been my ambition for years and years. And so I thought, well, I couldn't possibly study medicine, but maybe if I studied pharmacy, that would get me near enough to sort of helping people in with their health problems. So during my lunch hour, I was then living in Salford, I went to the Salford Tech, and I saw the head of the pharmaceutical department there. And I said, could I be a part-time student? And he said, yes. And so he kept talking to me, and he assumed that I must be working in a pharmaceutical firm and just wanted to study pharmacy to get promotion. But I had to go back to my machining job, and when I told him that I was a machinist making soldiers' uniforms, he was greatly amused, but he was very impressed, and I enrolled. But then, by that time, the British government had decided to intern male refugees. So my father and brother were already interned on the Isle of Man, and I was living on my own with my mother, who was always very scared when the air raid siren sounded. And I went to night school, and one day when there had been an air raid, and of course they wouldn't allow students to leave the college during the air raid. When it was over and I came home, I found my mother lying unconscious at the bottom of the stairs. So I had to admit her to hospital, and she had a slight stroke. So then I had to give up going to night school. So that was the end of that. And then 2 years later, again, I thought, well, maybe by that time I had become a costing clerk. First of all, a wages clerk in an ammunition firm, because, you know, I felt I was good in arithmetic, and it would be better to have a clerical job than being an unskilled machinist. And so I got this, and so I thought, well, maybe I could become a personal manageress, because there was personal management in that firm. And so I went to the College of Technology at Manchester and asked to take a course in personal management, evening classes. And the head of that department was just starting a 4 years evening classes course in industrial administration, of which personal management was one subject. So he was trying to recruit students, so he convinced me I should take this 4 years course. So I did. At the end of this, and one of the lectures, and economics was also a subject of that course, and the lecturer of that course was a fantastic guy. He was an ex-miner, a Geordie. And he had got a trade union scholarship to Ruskin College, Oxford. And from there, he'd won an extramural scholarship to Queen's College. and he got a first in PPE at Oxford. So he was obviously very bright. But he was still speaking with a broad Georgian accent, and therefore the academic establishment didn't really regard him or belonging to them. He was an outsider, he was marginal, and that's why he was teaching night school. And somehow he felt I had talent in economics. So, and that was the final year of this four-year course, and he said, what are you going to do now? By that time, I was the secretary of an export agency. It was already after the war. And so I said, I don't know, I'll try and get another job maybe. He said, well, I think you should study. You should take economics, you have talent. And I said, well, I can't. I must earn money, I must work, I must. So he said, well, there are scholarships. And so he then recommended me to Ruskin College, and I got a Ruskin College scholarship. And again, this was a tool, but you couldn't, and to this day, you can't take a degree at Ruskin College, only a diploma. And the diploma course, which was the sort of diploma in the lower grade to the PPA, the diploma in economics and political science is a two-year course. And when I came to Ruskin, I was so imbued with the Protestant ethics that, you know, you must work to earn your living. And then in your spare time, you can do what you really enjoy doing. So that to get paid for what I enjoyed doing, I felt was completely immoral. So I went to the principal and said, I can only stay 1 year. I can't stay 2 years. And they said, no, no, you know, you can't do a two-year course in 1 year. And I said, yes, I must. And so I think until this day, I'm the only one who ever did that diploma in 1 year. But then when it came to the beginning of the second semester, I had come to realize that it wasn't that immoral to get paid for what you enjoyed doing. So then I also tried to get a scholarship to university, become an undergraduate. And in 1951, after having spent 1 year at Ruskin, I got a scholarship to Manchester University, and I enrolled in economics. And as in the second year, we had to take a three-division subject. You had to do two subjects out of these three different ones. And these three subjects were political science, logic, and social anthropology. And at that time, I hadn't a clue what social anthropology was all about. So I then, having taken part of the Oxford Ruskin College diploma included political science and logic. And of course, I still had to try and support my parents, although I had a scholarship, but the scholarship wasn't enough. So I also had to earn money. So I worked as a market research investigator, and I taught what I'd learned in this course of industrial administration in night school. So I really had to rationalize my time for studying. And so I chose those two subjects and didn't try to investigate what social anthropology was all about. But then it turned out that the tutor in political science, our political views were directly opposed. And so I thought, that won't work. And so I thought, well, I must try social anthropology, find out what it was all about. And I went to a lecture that Max Gluckman gave, because at that time, he didn't have any, there was no degree, no first degree in social anthropology. So in a sense, he was just had this subsidiary subject and postgraduate student. And he was such a charismatic lecturer. I mean, I was absolutely enthralled this first lecture.
You remember what it was about?
Yes, what it was about, he lectured on why most anthropologists are marginal to their own societies. And this, of course, made sense to me, because my life, I was marginal in Austria because I was Jewish, I was marginal in England because I still have an accent, and so I'm not fully English, and I was marginal to all the groups of people that I've been involved with, so I thought that this was fantastic. And so I then decided on social anthropology. And for my degree, just about a week before I was, 2 weeks before I was due to take my final degree, and social anthropology was one subject, I had a very serious burn accident, and I was rushed into hospital. I was burned all along my right side, and I was bandaged and drips coming in. And so, but I was obsessed with these exams, because for me, this, and I already had a job offer from the John Lewis Partnership to train as a buyer. So if I hadn't had this accident, I would have become a buyer. So there were always other possibilities, but somehow something must have wanted me to become a social anthropologist. So I then had a friend who I asked to come. Asked my father to get her to come and see me in hospital right the day that I was admitted as an emergency case. And she came, and she was the wife of she was an adult student, and her husband was a rich guy who was having many businesses, and she was an important person. So I said, you must arrange for me to take these exams by hook or by crook, and she did. And Manchester University was just wonderful, because the staff volunteered to come as invigilators. I had to take the exams at exactly the same time as I would have had I not been burned. And of course, I couldn't use my right hand because it was all burned. And so the secretaries volunteered. There were, of course, no computers. There were typewriters. So the secretaries volunteered to come and take dictation, and would type whatever my answers that I would give. And the hospital gave me a private room for that. So, and I hit the headlines. I mean, there was then the News Chronicle was the major paper, the liberal paper, and my picture was on the front page, you know, heroine takes exam, and, you know. And it was quite fantastic how the British public responded, because I had flowers sent, chocolate sent, from people who, you know, didn't really know me but knew what I was doing. And then the invigilators came, you know, and Max Gluckman happened to be, he didn't realize, at the time when I was supposed to answer the paper in anthropology. And so when he realized this, I mean, can you imagine how it must have felt to dictate the answers when the professor sits next to you. Was really terribly embarrassing. So he then said to me, and he was wonderful, he said, Scarlett, I will not listen. Don't worry, I've brought a book and I won't hear what you're saying. So then I started, and actually in the middle of that paper, I just felt I couldn't go on, because they had put me on penicillin because the burns were going septic, and I was allergic to penicillin. So where I wasn't burned, I came out in big blobs, very itching, and I felt that was just about the end. And I said to Max, I'm sorry, Max, I have to give up. And he said, I won't let you. I won't let you. Said, I will allow you extra time. I will get the nurse and the doctor, and they will do something to relieve your pain, and you will go on, because you must give up, because I have faith in you, and I believe in you, and I need you. And to me, these words were, because you see, I was really the only student in economics that he thought he could get into anthropology because he'd had lawyers, you know, Bill was a barrister, and there were Dick Turner came from philosophy, and Derek Alcorn came from sociology, but no student of economics really wanted to go into anthropology, because as my experience has shown, the big firms think of graduates in economics as ideally suited for managerial training. And obviously once you get your degree and you can go into management training, you prefer this than going into anthropology as a graduate student, where there wasn't that opportunity at the end. Anyway, I then did, he called the doctor and nurse, and I continued. And after, at the end, when the paper had to then be put into the envelope and Max had to take it away, and before he left, he said, "Scarlett, I want to offer you a graduate scholarship." And that was before we ever knew what degree I would get. He said, and I backdated from the end of the academic year. And I then really, at the time, I didn't sort of think out what it would involve, what it would mean for me, for my future career. I mean, all I thought was, because even while I was in hospital, I had to help my parents financially. So I thought, well, if I get backdated. And the John Lewis Partnership, they were very nice. They kept writing me and telling me that they keep the job for me, but they weren't prepared to give me any salary or income while I wasn't there, before I could come on board. So that's how I came into anthropology. And then, when I was in hospital for 3 months and had skin grafting, and then I turned up. And he then said, well, I think what we like, and he discussed it with Arthur Lewis, and I'd got a 2-1, although they thought I would get a first had I not had to take the exam under the conditions in which I was. But I got a 2-1, which was good enough to get a postgraduate scholarship. And so then for the first year as a postgraduate student, Elizabeth Colson was there.
As you pass through now these famous figures, can you just give 1 minute pen portrait of these people if you want to? I mean, Elizabeth Colson, what was she?
Yeah, well, Elizabeth Colson was fantastic. There was another refugee graduate student who came from Czechoslovakia, and he'd taken his first degree in, I think, social welfare. And he was also interested in anthropology, and Max also wanted him. So we were sort of first-year postgraduate students together, and Elizabeth Colson was our supervisor. And so I invited Elizabeth once for dinner, right, and this other student, his name was Paul Dixon, also came along. And she then said, well, you give me the parameters of a society, and I will develop the society for you. I'll give you a profile of the society. So it was like a game. But now, not so long ago, I used this, I remembered this, and I have now come up in a manual, which I call a manual for culturally adapted market research in the development process, with a concept of key cultural variables. And I'm now training third world trainers of local investigators in compiling a list of key cultural variables and just conducting a few focus group discussions and in-depth interviews, and to know how these key cultural variables operate in the target society in which they focus. And this then enables them to come up with a cultural profile. So in a sense, I've operationalized what I learned from Elizabeth many, many years ago, and I've told her that. And she was quite amused. So, and then during that first year, then Max wanted me to go to Central Africa, where of course he had this connection with the Rhodes Livingston Institute. And again, he'd had all sorts of other graduate students coming from different disciplines, but he hadn't had an economist. So he wanted me to go and do a study of tribal economics. And it never occurred, and somehow Africa didn't really excite me, but I'd always, since I was a little girl, I'd always adored India. India had always been a fairy tale country, and it still is. And as it so happened, M.N. Srinivas was visiting professor at the time at Manchester during my first postgraduate year in anthropology. And there were, I think Sheila Cunnison was also, but we were only two women, and all the others were men. So we were in great demand. And M.N. Srinivas also asked me to, would I come out for dinner with him to a restaurant one night, and I did. And I said to him, just jokingly, I said, can you get me a job as a sweeper in India? He said, why do you want to come as a sweeper? So I said, well, I think that may be the only chance I ever have to come to India. He said, why do you want to come to India? And I said, yes, I've always wanted to. He said, well, why don't you come and do your PhD studies in India? And I said, well, Max Kleckmann, he's already got me a scholarship to go to Central Africa. Of course, then it was still Northern Rhodesia. And I said, well, it never occurred to me that I would have the right to choose the area where I should do my study. He said, well, you tell him that you want to go to India. He wanted me to come to. So I did the next day, shaking in my boots. I went to Max and I said, Max, you know, I've had dinner with Professor Srinivas last night, and he thought if I wanted to come to India, would you agree? And I must say he was taken aback, but Max was very fair. He said, look, Scarlett, for 1 month, neither Srinivas nor I will speak with you, because neither of us should influence you. It's your decision, your future life, and you must decide. At the end of the month, you must come to me. And if you decide India, then I would have to go try and find money from somewhere else. So, and since these two professors were the big guys in the department, and the rest of the graduate students were either with one or the other, I was like an untouchable. Nobody talked with me since the big guys didn't. And so after about 2 or 3 days, I went to Max and I said, India, please. And he then got me a Rockefeller Research Fellowship to go to India, and Srinivas met me on arrival at Bombay, and he was just wonderful to me.
Can you say something about him?
Of course, he was my Indian supervisor, and he had such a wonderful sense of humor, and he was such a modest guy. He was really a wonderful person, and he became a very close friend of mine. And whenever in subsequent years, whenever I went to India, I stayed with them in Bangalore. And he helped me to find the village. He helped me to find a teacher to learn the vernacular, and I mean, without him, I just couldn't have managed. Well, I might have done, but certainly it would have been much, much more difficult. And my last memory of him before he died was I was in Bangalore in, must have been 1999, showing my documentary film, because one of the guys that was a little boy in the irrigated village which I studied, called Mangala, became one of the highly respected IAS officers. And he, of course, to him, my books are his Bible, and he calls me mother, and his sons write to me, and dear grandmother. And he was very, and of course he also appears in this film, and he was greatly involved in the making of this film. And so he arranged a whole day session, being a high-ranking IAS officer in Bangalore. The film was shown, and it was a whole day meeting for the Department of Agriculture, Rural Development, and all everybody who had was even only remotely interested in rural development. And of course, Emin Srinivas was also invited. And there were speeches made, as usual, at these functions. And then they asked me to make a speech, and I said, I don't like to make speeches, I like to listen. And then they asked Srinivas to make a speech, and he said, and I still remember this, and this was still makes me feel very happy, he said, the biggest thing, biggest and best thing he thinks he has done for India's, for South Indian development, and particular Karnataka development, is that he is responsible for having brought Scarlett Epstein along. So this was a crowning success. And a few weeks afterwards, his wife phoned me and told me, I was back in England, that he just died. And it's a great loss.
Right, so you had arrived in India to do field work in two villages near Mysore. Can you sort of summarize the main findings? It's a very famous study which influenced me a lot, both the methodology and the conclusions, but can you sort of synthesize or give impressions of what you felt when you arrived in these villages?
Well, the villages actually have become my home. And recently, when I wanted to have another film make, and the producer asked me, why are you so keen to have these village voices heard? Which is, you know, it's become like an obsession with me. I must get this done, and if it's the last thing I ever do. And then I hadn't really sat down and thought it out, what makes me so committed. And as I said earlier, I had been marginal to all the societies. And I mean, even the anthropologists for a long time never thought of me as an anthropologist. And they thought of me as a person who'd ever been initiated into the Tola, you know, the Papua New Guinea male secret society. And I had a movie camera, and I got one of the young guys, an American student, to film it. And I had the film, and then I gave it for copying, and they wiped it off. So I haven't got it.
Dreadful.
Which is, you know, which had been absolute. Anyway.
Anyway, you were saying that you've always been marginal.
Yes. So I was marginal because the anthropologists at first, and for many years, never thought of me as an anthropologist, but thought of me as an economist. And I think in a sense I was one of the pioneers of development anthropology, because, you know, because I knew my co-supervisor, well, the major supervisor, was Arthur Lewis.
Can you say something about him?
Yeah, well, he was also fantastic. He, before I got my first degree, the big firms go headhunting to the university employment bureaus. And, of course, I was an obvious, because I was an adult student, and I was expected to get a first. And so one day Arthur Lewis rang me and said, there's a professor from Durban, from South Africa here, who is looking for staff in economies, looking for staff, and he'd asked him to recommend, and he recommended me. And so at that time, this was before my accident, I went round England because I got so many invitations for interviews, and I hadn't seen much of England by that time. So I met this guy in London at SOAS. He'd got a room there. And he interviewed me, and there and then he offered me a senior lectureship. And I was absolutely in seventh heaven. I could see myself with a first degree stepping straight into a senior lectureship. And then when I went back to Manchester and I told Arthur Lewis, and he said, Scarlett, I don't want you to go to South Africa. He said, they are racist, you're Jewish. He said, of course, he was black. And he had come across a lot of racism in this country. And he said, I don't want to go to South Africa. And he was also very wonderful when I had to take the exam in hospital. But then when I decided to go and do 2 years field work in South India, he said to me, Scarlett, I think you must be mad for a bright young graduate in economics to bury yourself for 2 years in South Indian villages. You must be mad. But subsequently, many years later, and of course I got him to write the foreword to my first book, which he did very nicely. And we kept in touch. And then in the late 1970s, I was a trustee of the Agricultural Development Council, which had been started by John D. Rockefeller III. And I was the only woman among the trustees. I was the only non-American among the trustees. And I was also, most of them were economists, and they regarded me as an anthropologist. So in a sense, I was marginal to the economists. I was marginal to the anthropologists. So by that time, I met Arthur Lewis was at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, and the ADC, the Agricultural Development Council, usually had at least one board meeting every year, which was quite great for me because I had expenses, paid trips to America, and we met at Princeton, so my colleagues knew that I knew Arthur, and so they said, can you invite Arthur to our cocktail party? And I did, and he came along. And I went up to him and I said, Arthur, do you still think I was mad spending 2 years? He said, no. Well, with hindsight, I think it was quite a clever investment. And of course it was. I mean, for me, it really set me up. And now to come to the villages, when I said I was marginal to, in Austria, in England, economists, anthropologists, and even to the Jewish communities, I'm marginal, because I grew up as a complete atheist, and although I married Bill, and I'm now pretty active, but I'm not really accepted as a fully fledged member of the Jewish community. And my Mangala villagers are the only society that I've ever been with that say, you are one of us. And since my field work, of course then, when I came back and I met Bill and we got married, and together we went to Australia, and then together we used the ANU, the Australian National University, as base to do studies in what was then New Guinea, and we went to the Gazelle Peninsula together. But I've always somehow felt I belong to this South Indian village. And then when we came back to England and I joined the IDS, the Institute of Development Studies at the University of Sussex, and we then had two professors in the house, I had the opportunity to go back fairly frequently to South India, and of course every time I go to India I must get back to my villages, and there are always receptions and garlands and parties and farewell parties, and at the last farewell party, and obviously the film also, I told them they were all film stars now, and when the film came out, the Anthropological Survey of India, the director came to Mysore University, because we didn't only show the film in Delhi. It was also launched in London at the Commonwealth Institute, and in India, in Delhi, and in Bangalore, and in Mysore, and the director of the Anthropological Survey came specially from Calcutta to Mysore for the launch of the film. And we then took the film also to the villages. And at a farewell party, I got up and I said, well, you know, I'm now getting old, and this may be the last time that I'll ever be able to be here. And one young guy who wasn't even a thought in his parents' mind when I was there first got up and said, don't you worry yourself, you will be reborn as one of us. So it's very comforting to know where I'll be in my next existence. The experience of staying in India and in these villages was really not only academically and intellectually very challenging and very satisfying, but emotionally for me, it was also a healing process. I felt at last I belonged.
How many times have you been to India now? Because you went in...
Well, 54. I was there from 54 to 56.
And then 1970.
In 1972, I went back. It's 1970. I went back. And since then, since we moved back to Sussex in 1972, I must have been back at least a dozen times, possibly.
You went 78 and 93, and then sometimes since then you've been a number of times.
Oh, yes. Mm. And I will be there again this year. Now, to Papua New Guinea, yes. That was also a very interesting experience. But although I get on very well and I'll be off again to Papua New Guinea next month, and I have many friends in high places, but somehow emotionally it's never taken the place that my South Indian villages are occupying in my mind, in my emotional life. And I also find it much easier to relate to Indians, and particularly South Indians, than, I like Africans, I like Papua New Guinea, I like anybody. But, the emotional linkage is really with the South Indian culture. But Papua New Guinea was also very exciting. Of course, it was easier also because Bill was then not very far. We didn't stay together. We decided that it wouldn't do our marriage much good to work in the same society, because there are not many marriages between husband and wife, both being anthropologists, that have lasted. We discussed this once with Raymond and Rosemary, who are of course the model marriage of anthropologists that has lasted. But we weren't terribly far apart, and we also, I used to go to Bill's place every weekend and sort of go with my villagers to the market in Rabaul, the main town, and then Bill was near Rabaul and I would spend the night with him and go back on Sunday. But I then became the first European woman ever to dance with the local women. Because in a sense, in New Guinea, one can't help but feel that contact hasn't done them much good. They were much happier before the Europeans arrived on their horizon. They had ample food, there was ample land, and very fertile soils, because it's all volcanic. You don't even have to plant anything. You can eat a pineapple, throw it away, and a pineapple will grow. And they had so many feasts and so many dances and all decorations and tribal dances and secret societies. And they had a very developed cultural life. So when I was there, they, and they, of course, the missionaries, came along, and they all became very good Christians. And so they had buried, before the missionaries came, they buried their dead sort of hickety-pickety. They didn't have a cemetery. You know, you would bury your parents outside your own home, and these would be spread. They had a hamlet style of living. So when the missionaries that came along, and they felt they wanted to have a cemetery, so they were digging up their dead, and it was quite, I found it quite amusing very often when people used to sit over a dead body that they had unearthed. I mean, they didn't bury them in coffins, they just buried the bodies. And they would argue, and one would say, this is my uncle, and somebody else would say, no, this is my uncle, and they couldn't decide whose uncle he was. And of course, they are a matrilineal society, so, you know, the uncle relationship was very important. Anyway, then they had this, they finally managed to have cemeteries, and they wanted to have tombstones, and so they put tombstones, and to start this cemetery, you know, declare it as finally established, they had to have a feast with lots of dancers. And so I was asked to join the dancers. And of course they, and it's very interesting because they regard the dress which the missionaries actually introduced, because before missionaries appeared, they just had a sort of G-string and nothing at the top. Now the missionaries, of course, they introduced loose blouses and lap-laps, loincloth. And they regard this now as their traditional dress. If you ask them, you know, they say, that's our tradition. So then they said, well, each dance, there is a choreographer for each dance, and there's also a guy who designs the dress, the costumes for the dance, and everyone gets paid in shell money. And they were actually, before European contact, what I have come to call primitive capitalists. I mean, I wrote a book about them called Capitalism, Primitive and Modern, and they were really primitive capitalists because they had shell money, there was a price for everything, and they even had the concept of a bank and of rate of interest. Because if you wanted liquid cash, because you would store your accumulated shell money savings, you would make coils of shell money. And one such coil would look like a big tire of a truck. And this would be your accumulated wealth. And in one of these coils, there might be as many as 1,000 fathoms of shell money. So that was a hell of a lot. And you would then, if you are a rich man, and of course anthropologists know it's the big man system, if you are a big man and you have many such coils of shell money, you then had a house, a hut built, and you would put all your earthly wealth into it, you would put your coils of shell money into it. And so to protect it from theft, you would pay a guy to stand and guard it. And, I mean, for instance, Parkinson's 30 years in the South Sea relates that when there were fights between different settlements, and women would run, and of course the big men would then try and save the coils of shell money, and some of the women would carry, and they would have a child either on their back or around their hip, and on the other arm a coil of shell money. And if it meant a decision which to drop, the child or the shell money, the child would be dropped, because you can have another child, but it's very difficult to accumulate a lot of shell money. So they were really primitive capitalists. And to my greatest surprise, one of our Indian colleagues at the Australian National University, Professor Madan, wanted my book on Papua New Guinea to appear in India. And I couldn't for the life of me think why he was interested in. But in India, many of the academics were very left-wing, and quite a number were card-holding members of the Communist Party. But he was a fairly middle-of-the-road academic. And so what he was being accused all the time of being a great conservative, and he used my book to show that there were, that the story of Marxian evolution, you know, that you first had slavery, and there was primitive capitalism, that there was never primitive communism, which was Marxist assumption. So that was interesting. And so at this festival to celebrate the beginning of a cemetery in this village, in the hamlet area where I stayed, I was asked to lead the dance. And I then had to get the same uniform as all the other women, which meant a navy Mary blouse, because these are the loose blouses that the missioners introduced, that women can easily raise and breastfeed their babies, and a laplap, a black laplap and a blue Mary blouse. And I must admit, when I tried it on, Bill and I, we had a good laugh. I looked awful. But then when I came back to my village and I showed them that I'd got the right uniform, they looked at me and my female friends and they said, "Well, now you look really nice." They never liked to look dressed in my old style of dress.
Is there anything in particular you would like to just put on record, either about a particular person like Bill or a teacher or people?
Well, I mean, I've said about Bill, yes.
He was obviously terribly important. You dedicate, or at least you write a lot about him in the preface to one of your books here. We worked together.
Yes, well, I mean, Bill became my mentor. He was my Encyclopedia Britannica, and in a sense, when he died, I didn't only lose a husband. We had a very happy marriage, but I lost a partner, a working partner, because we were really very complementary. He was the philosopher. He was extremely widely read. I'd never had the chance to read anywhere near as much as he had. And he was much more theoretically inclined, whereas my sort of background and, you know, the survival strategies that I had learned when I was younger obviously formed my approach. And so what I really felt, and I'm still doing this, is to try and make whatever research we conduct useful to help at least a small group of people to improve their quality of life. And Bill always gave me the ideas, and I was very good in operationalizing them. So we often had arguments. I always said, before I died, I said, who's going to be the more be remembered, and I always said, I won't be remembered. You have made all the contribution to theory, and I'm just a sort of practitioner. And he always said, yes, but more people know about you, what you do, than what he's been doing. Which is, of course, true, because I write much more popular style. I mean, for instance, with Sage Publications, that now produced the last book and keep on producing my publications, they write to me and say, have you got anything in the pipeline? Because my books sell, they are much more popular. I mean, Bill's books were much more, esoteric and wouldn't attract a very large reading public. Whereas Village Voices, 40 years of rural transformation in South India, and if you've seen the book, you will see that the first paragraph, I say, well, if you expect the same type of book as I'd published before, like South India, Yesterday, Today and Tomorrow, and particularly the first one, Economic Development and Social Change in South India, then forget about reading this one, because with this one, I am not producing any tables in it, no bibliography. I really want this book to be read widely, and we seem to have achieved it. because it's been selling extremely well, and it's in already, I don't know, in the 14th or 15th edition. So, you know, it's the kind of book that people may pick up even at an airport, you know, Village Voices, 40 years of rural transformation. So, you know, Bill and I, and I miss him every day because he was my mentor and he gave me the idea and he was such a lovely guy.